Welcome to the MicroConf Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Walling. In this episode, we pull audio from one of our most popular main stage MicroConf talks. This talk was given by Peldy Gilzoni, the founder of Balsamiq at MicroConf Europe in Dubrovnik in 2024. And the title is 33 Minutes of No BS Tactics I Used to Build a $6.6 million a Year SaaS. Peldy is one of our most prolific MicroConf speakers. I believe he's done 4 or 5 sessions. I think most of them were talks. I think he did an AMA as well. He is an incredibly accomplished and thoughtful founder who is one of the best startup speakers out there. So it was a pleasure to see him in Dubrovnik and a pleasure to see this video on YouTube, which I would highly recommend because his slides are great. And if you want to learn more about all of our upcoming events and potentially attend MicroConf Europe here in a few months, MicroConf US in spring of next year, head to microconf.com/events. And with that, let's dive into Peldy's 33 minutes of no BS tactics.
So we all start as makers. And so, you know, you build something that makes you a maker. And then maybe what you made starts getting some traction. So then you're a successful maker, right? And this is where the trouble begins. Because you can't just stop there because you got something and it has some traction. You got to do something with it. Well, at some point, you got to incorporate. And so now you're a founder. So many of you are at this stage now where you have to figure out how to create a company. Talk to lawyers and accountants and all that, right? But being a founder is amazing. It's such a great job title, right? So many people aspire to be founders, right? Some people are like this for a long time. Then at some point, if you're still successful, you're going to need help. And then you have to make a big choice. You have to hire somebody and then turn into a manager. And then this was very hard for me to do because I've never managed anybody before. And I'm a great maker. And so I was at a point where I had to switch my job. And so the company was going to lose the best maker and gain a shitty manager at the same time. And the company's just getting traction, right? And so it's a very dangerous moment. And it takes a lot of guts to make this jump. So then at some point, years later, you're not supposed to make anymore. I'm not allowed in the code base anymore. And because there's many other people, the code base has evolved, et cetera. And so you have to delegate all the making, and now you're a CEO. Again, I didn't go to business school. I don't know what a CEO does, but you have to figure it out, right? Then, if you're in business for many years, then you start thinking about legacy. And so that means you have to build a strong leadership team, and you have to step away from the day-to-day of the operation, and that makes you a business owner, right? As if you had a restaurant, you don't work there, you have a manager that manages it and all that. But you own the business, right? Very different job altogether again. And then I think you can't call yourself an entrepreneur until maybe you do this last step, which is either selling the business or starting another business, where really the business is a thing. It's like a separate thing from you, right? So many of us, our identity is so closely tied to our baby, right? But if you reach step 7, that's not your baby anymore. That's just a thing that you made back in the day, right? So this is a tough journey. Not everybody will do the whole journey. Some companies might go out of business at step 3, you know, or get sold at step 4 or step 5. Or if you have a co-founder, one of you might do the whole journey. The other one will stop at some point, right? But, you know, I hope this slide scares you a little. Because this is what happens if you're successful. You know, like you have to change all these jobs in your career. You're about to change all these jobs. So you start as a maker. I want to build things. Probably you quit your job because you were tired of all this bureaucracy and you just wanted to make. Well, guess what? If you're successful, you're going to be the bureaucracy. So today, hopefully, I'll make this a little bit easier and help you avoid some of the mistakes that I've made in my journey. All right, so let's start with what is a business. So for many years, this was the quote that I lived by. Your business is your second product. I was like, perfect. I know how to build a product. Features, bugs, every new policy of the business is going to be a feature. Every problem to solve is going to be a bug. I've done this before. I can do this again for the business, right? It's very attractive. Problem is, it's terrible. It's very dangerous advice. I spent so much time reinventing the wheel when it came to how to run a business because we had to do everything the balsamic way, right? And then inevitably, over the years, these policies that we came up with, we had to evolve and evolve and evolve until they look like normal HR policies. Okay. So your business is not a product. Your business is a human power system, right? Like democracy. You're not going to build democracy feature by feature, right? It's a system of people that that have to work together in the right way. Your job is not to invent the rules of the game. Your job is not to innovate here. Your job is to innovate on the product. So there are some things you can choose here. You can choose the company culture that you like, whether you're more of a synchronous guy or asynchronous, introvert, extrovert, depending on your preference, office versus remote, more aggressive and faster and or versus more laid back. That I feel like as the founder, you get to set the tone for that. And that can stay throughout the life of the business. Another thing that I always say is you choose the problem you want to solve. But depending on this choice, this dictates your company size and your company playbook. Quick example. I want to feed the burgers to a neighborhood. Food truck, right? Okay. Well, then you're not going to get VC funding. You're not going to go public. You're not going to hire more than two people because they don't fit in the truck, right? Vice versa, I want to eradicate malaria, right? You're not going to bootstrap that. Only Bill Gates can maybe try to fix that, right? It takes hundreds of people and so much money, right? So you choose the problem you want to solve, and that problem comes with the expected company size and playbook. And then you choose the system of rules that you want to use to run the company. And here, there's this idea of build versus buy. So should I build everything from scratch like I used to, or should I just adopt an existing system? And so this talk is to show you that maybe you should adopt the system and maybe tweak some configuration files, basically.
If you're enjoying this talk from MicroConf Europe, you should consider joining us for our next one in Istanbul, Turkey, at the end of September 2025. Our last two events have completely sold out, and we expect that to be the same for this event. To get all the info and to get your ticket before they sell out, head to microconf.com/Europe.
And so there's a lot of these systems around. Most of you have heard of this. Lean Startup, this is a system for companies that want to scale quickly, you know, Silicon Valley type thing. But the beauty of these systems is that they always come with a book. They're documented. They come with consultants that you can hire to help you implement them. You know, here's another Holacracy. I think this is what Zappos and Spotify use. If you don't want to buy a whole system, you can go one level down in granularity and buy some different These things are, you know, mostly free, but use some different plays, right? Atlassian has this nice website with different things on how to run a retrospective, how to do recruiting, different pieces, right? This one is called EOS. It's one that's very popular. It's based on not one, but five books. This is used by several companies my size, balsamic size, and so we're looking into implementing it ourselves now, 16 years later. But what's good about these is that, like, the traction book is for the founder. Then there's How to Be a Great Boss, which is for managers of companies that are implementing EOS. There's What the Heck is EOS for employees, individual contributors of companies that are implementing EOS. And the thing about choosing an existing system that is so well documented is that not only there's books, there's also a ton of consultants that you can hire. There's videos on YouTube. ChatGPT is fluent in these systems. We created one EOS expert and it fed all the books, and we can ask, how do you do this in EOS, right? So it's like choosing Tailwind over bare bones CSS. You know what I mean? It just makes things easier. It's proven. This is their whole job, right? The traction book is 4th or 5th edition, right? They always evolve it, right? So today I'm not going to give you a full system. I'm just going to show you a bunch of tools and tactics that you guys can use, that things that we are either implementing or we've implemented or we're looking into, that maybe give you a little bit of an overview of things that you can steal, basically. And I've noticed every presentation now has a ChatGPT, a Midjourney image in it. So check, I've done that. All right, structure. So, you know, this one, if you're a programmer, you know this saying, absolutely, right? You don't want to over-engineer things ahead of time. Well, waiting too long hurts just as much. You know, Balsamiq was a flat company for many, many years, which was not true, because humans are pack animals and leaders emerge and followers emerge. And so if you say you're flat, actually you're not. And the managers you have, the leaders you have, don't have the job title. So they're not studying how to become a better manager. They can make big mistakes and they're not accountable for them because it's not their job, really. And so structure, an org chart, the sooner the better. EOS has this, they call it accountability chart, because it's an org chart with some roles as well. Like, okay, this is what this role is supposed to do. 5 short bullets on what they are accountable for. Rob has a whole chapter in the SaaS playbook, which I hope you all have, about how to structure your team. So look at that. So I would say, as soon as you hire 2-3 people, have somebody be a manager, you know, put this structure in place. This was probably my biggest mistake. It took us too long. This other thing I remember, oh, we don't have job titles. Those are very corporate. You know, we're totally startup-y. That was another mistake. Why not? I mean, your employees, they go to conferences. They want to be able to have, to say what they do with a name that people understand. You know, they're looking for jobs. They want to know what their job is. So now we have straight up job titles that we don't even come up with. We buy them. There's this company, ERI, that has a salary data from around the world, and they have a list of 6,000 jobs. These are all the jobs. Zoologist, assistant professor. And we just go through the list and we're like, okay, you're closest to this one. You're closest to this one. And so this is the copy paste description for product managers. We have a little translation, because some of it might not map exactly. We have a multiplier. I'll talk about that later when we do a salary, but it's connected to this. And then we go down and we say, okay, these are the hard skills for a product manager. And you have all that once. And here's what it means to do at a level 1, level 2, level 3. And this gives a level of clarity to employees. It makes coaching and performance review so much easier, because you're like, oh, I do this at level 1, I do this at level 2. Actually, I disagree, blah, blah, blah. Soft skills, same thing. We have these long tables that we made. Again, now you can ask ChatGPT to come up with these super, super big pages. But anyways, your job as the CEO is to provide clarity. This took me so many years to understand. I thought I had to be the helper. I thought I had to take the trash out. I thought I had to be able to do every single thing. Yes, but those things, eventually you delegate. This one, providing clarity, is the last thing. You can't really delegate it, what I'm learning. It's what people really require you to do as the boss, as the CEO. So you've seen these a million times. There's all these different ways to talk about values, measure, mission. And again, I was talking to Rob last night. At the beginning of this startup, we're like, oh, this is not for me. There's just a couple of us. Why do we need all this, right? Trust me. Do it now and start getting into the habit of doing these things now. There's different, if you search these Some people put values first. Some people put vision first. Some people call mission what the others call vision. It's messy, but just come up with your own hierarchy and definition, and you'll be fine. This is what we do. I don't know if you want, you know, I'll spend 30 seconds on it. You know, the values is kind of our North Star. That's what guides us. The vision is a snapshot in time. 10 years from now, what does it look like? It's not a path. It's a snapshot. You know, close your eyes. Imagine yourself 10 years from now. What's the company look like? What's the product look like? What are the financials looking like? Right? Then the mission is how we're going to get all the way down there. We have to put some milestones in. And so those are goals, 3-year goals. Then you have a strategy, and the strategy is how we're going to get to the first goal specifically. And then from the strategy, you have roadmaps that are quarterly. Roadmaps are a collection of projects, right? So this is how we use it. By the way, I see people taking pictures. The slides are going to be available, so don't worry about that. One way to figure out your vision is, this is again stolen from EOS, answer these two questions. Why does our organization exist? What's our passion? What's our cause? And what can we do better than everybody else? What's our niche? What's our secret sauce? They seem very simple questions. It took me and my managers 5 meetings to come to agree on what these should be right now. Okay. But now we're aligned. Now we have clarity. We know what the vision should be. Another way to come up with a good vision is to understand your client, your customers. This is a quote that, something that I feel very deeply in my soul, which is that the company that wins is the one that understands their customers better. Seems kind of silly, but it takes a lot of work to be that company, right? Right now we do it with a combination of qualitative and quantitative data. This is Jessica. She's a user researcher at Balsamiq. She's been there since we were 10 people at the company, so pretty early on. Her job is to interview customers all day, every day, and gather insights and put them in Jira. Hugely important. Just this year, after 16 years, we started asking 4 questions during sign up. What's your job? And again, do it right away, you know. Now it's expected. Before I was like, no, we don't want to bother them, right? Now people expect it, and it's fine. It takes, on average, it takes our customers 8 seconds to go through the wizard, so no big deal. But be careful, because you don't want to only do the quantitative. I know it's very attractive. We're programmers. We don't want to talk to people, right? Let's just look at the data. Well, at the beginning, you're not going to have enough data to actually be statistically significant. And so it's really dangerous to only look at the data. This is a framework that I just rediscovered after many years from Kent Beck, the extreme programming guy. He liked the letter X. So he came up with this framework of explore, expand, extract. And so at the beginning, when you're just getting started, you're in the exploration phase, right? You don't have product market fit yet. In this phase, don't look at data. Data is not important to you. Just go more qualitative, interview people, get feedback. One of the reasons I was successful is that at the beginning, very beginning, I gave Balsamiq away to everybody in exchange for an honest review. That was gold for me. I needed to know what was the roughest corner of the app to work on next, right? So just get reviews, interview people at the beginning. Then you find product market fit, and then, you know, things explode. But then at the end, it's going to flatten out. That's where we are now. And so now we're like, okay, let's look at the data. Let's extract more value out of this thing that is 15 years old, right? So data is important, but use it carefully. Anyways, that's how you get to the vision. Then this is how we do strategy. And I've never seen this chart in the online, so I thought I'd share it. This works really well for us. It's a very simple chart. So it's strategy. So it's how we're going to get to the next goal, right? So it's 3 years, maybe a couple of years, not that much further. And on the y-axis is focus or effort. What are we going to do? And these are not projects. These are collections of projects. Each row is a collection of projects. And so if it's high, we know that that's the focus. I'll show you another one. This is the one of the teams. Every group has their own focus. So this shows you that for Q4, they want to do a new design system and dark mode. Everything else is below. I like to leave a big gap between the top focus thing and the rest. And then there's some horizontal lines like delighters. We always want to sprinkle in a delighter every quarter, okay? But then there's chores that come and go, things that finish. One nice thing about these charts is that you can put some arrows in the future, and that really helps to say, instead of saying, no, we're not doing AI, is saying, no, AI is planned for next year. And that really helps when you have to say no, which is a big part of your job, right? You can say, okay, yeah, we're doing it, but no, we're not doing it until starting January, okay? So we do these for our HR team does it too. End of the year work is starting now. It's going to end in Q2, blah, blah, blah. IT certification, long initiative. It's going to take a long time. And so we put it in here. So again, this provides us with clarity on what the next few years are going to look like. Then you go to this quarterly roadmap. And so based on the strategy chart, we pick things that fit with that strategy. And one tip that I have here is to split the roadmap into kinds of jobs. So we have QA jobs, pivotal or Jira batches, you know, little, let's take this corner of the app that has a bunch of bugs on it. Let's fix all those, right? That's a batch. And then big features, small features, process improvements. This is useful because you know your team and you can say, well, we can only do one or two big features a quarter and maybe three small features. So you put numbers on here and that helps everybody plan properly without overcommitting or undercommitting. Again, it's about being aligned and quality. And we staff them ahead of time, the different groups who's going to be responsible. Then this is another nice trick, what we call pick pages. The title of the page is pick what to work on in Q4, right? Now I just started one for Q1 for the next quarter. And what is this? This is a buffer. This is during the quarter, everybody sets down on their projects, on the roadmap, but ideas come up from support, from the founders, from everybody. Ideas come up. And the temptation is so strong to like, oh yeah, let's investigate that. Let's spend 2 hours talking about it, see what it would look like, blah, 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 right? That's a huge distraction. So instead, we say, put them on here. Great idea, put it on the page. So that then, at the end of the quarter, when it's time to plan the next quarter, then there's a moment where everybody's open to new ideas. The stuff is shipped. We're in planning mode. So let's have all the discussions, and then we pick for the roadmap. And then immediately we create another empty page so that people can fill it up. Huge. This is huge for avoiding distraction. All right. All this stuff is also useful for coaching, evaluating. This is company values. Again, you feel like, why do I need company values? Well, that's the main thing that defines your culture. Okay. So you really want to have those. You want to have them on the website. That's how you attract the right kind of people to your company. One thing about company value, they have an expiration date. Always put an expiration date. 3 years, maybe 4 years, but that's it. Always set the expectation that this is the company values right now. We're going to change them again in 4 years. Always tell everybody that because you have to. The company evolves under your feet, whether you like it or not. It's different people, different stage of the company. You have to update the company values to take a snapshot of what it actually is right now. So this was our old one from 2019. We are redoing them now because they're not very actionable. They're too fluffy, too sort of high level and inspirational. Instead, EOS has this thing called the People Analyzer, which is a way to sort of do some performance review of your employees. And they put the values right at the top. And for each value, you have to be able to say for each person, whether they're doing it most of the time, they live that value sometime or rarely. Okay. And so you have to have values that are easy to say, yes, they do that or not. Like be efficient, be accountable, right? These are things that you can tell immediately. If you say, be a good teammate, that's too vague, right? And this is what they use to do performance review. If somebody has a minus in any of the value, they have to go. They have to fix it quickly or have to go. Okay. So use values that you can use day to day. Don't make them too inspirational. Another tool is skills map. This is where you take all the skills that I showed you before for the job. This is again, product management, and you self-rate yourself 1 to 5 on each of them. You say where you want to get in the future, and then you can make a beautiful little chart that shows, hey, right now I'm in the green zone, in the gray diagram, but I want to get to green. And the beauty of this especially is to put all of the ones from your team together, where you see, do I have a well-rounded team or not? In this case, you know, we're pretty weak on user research. You can see it at a glance that we need to improve our user research as a group. So maybe we hire somebody or we train somebody, right? Because we want a well-rounded team. Or maybe not. Maybe it's a conscious choice that 2 is enough for us, you know? So that's another tool. Then again, clarity, job descriptions, salary. I could do a whole talk about that, about how to set up salaries. And so we are remote, we are global, so we buy salary data because it's easy to find for the US, but it's much harder to find for Europe. And there's these companies that's all they do. They do surveys and they update salary data for all those 6,000 jobs around the world. And so we take that data and turn them into ranges. So for this one job, there's level 1, 2, and 3, and that's the salary range that you're going to do if you're at that level. The way we calculate this is with pretty much a formula. This is a person that has 2 jobs. They do 70% one job, 30% the other job. They're a level 3 with 13 years of experience in the first one. They're a level 2 with 8 years of experience of the second one. We give a balsamic premium on some jobs. If there's jobs that are historically done by women, those are paid less in the market, so we add a 10% on that. If there are some jobs that are overpaid, we reduce 10% because we don't want too much of an over. We don't want managers to be paid that much more than individual contributors because we want individual contributors to also feel like they don't have to go into management to make more money. So we make a few adjustments to the data, but it's mostly based on the data that we buy. And we update that every year so that inflation is taken into account. So we're pretty proud of this system. And it makes it so that it's pretty fair. Every manager, we have 6 different groups now, teams, and every manager cannot really mess it up too much because they have to use the same system. Some tools for collaborating. Sorry, I know I'm flooding you with information, but the slides are going to be available. This is something that we do, HUG, Human User Guide. Some people call this a README, where you write a little page about yourself, what you're like, your history, what my working hours are, where am I, when it's time to schedule me, how to collaborate with me, how to give me feedback, yes or not, you know, this different ways. So, you know, Pelly has a low patience for lying, scheming, gossiping. So each person, a balsamic, has one of these. And so if you're working with someone that you don't normally work with, you can immediately go look at their HUG so that you have a little bit of instructions on how to deal with them. Okay. So that takes 10 minutes to do and useful, very useful. At a team level, we do these team agreements, and these are tiny contracts. Each bullet is a tiny contract that we say, as a team, we agree to take good notes during the meeting, right? So that we have notes. We could do to do all retrospectives within 2 weeks. We sit together and we say, you know, this is how we're going to collaborate. And it's very short. It's not this short. It's very actionable. Often these are results of tensions that have happened. And we're like, okay, we did this wrong. Let's figure out how do we want to do it. Okay, we write it down, we commit to it. And we review these every quarter. We see if we lived up to them or not, if we need to change them, add them, remove. Very easy, very useful. I want to spend a little time on the double diamond. You're all familiar with that, I hope. We recently started doing discovery much more deeply than before. It resulted in better features, better projects altogether. How we do discovery, we plan for it, and we do some desk research. And this is looking at everything we know about this problem, from customer feedback, bugs, everything we have internally, similar projects that we've done in the past. Excuse me. Competitive research. How do they solve the same problem? Best practice research. Ask ChatGPT, how do you solve this problem? Right? And we write it all down. Then we do stakeholder interviews. We talk to everybody in the group, inside the company or also customers. And we say, okay, what do you know about this problem? What are you expecting about this project? What's success for you? What timeline do you expect? You know, basically getting everybody heard. Then we do user research. We go and interview customers sometimes. It depends on the project. But like, okay, we're thinking of doing this. What do you think, right? And here's where you can show them wireframes. And then as you do all this research, you get insights. And you write them down, little bullets. Then from that, you can turn them into solution statements. Then you go into design mode. We're like, okay, I understood. These are the problems. What are possible solutions? And some are not code. Some are like, we need a video to illustrate this. We need a new tutorial. We need to change a process, right? But if you do discovery right, you'll be able to have much better solutions. Then, very important, split the development phase in two. Prototype, quick and dirty, as quickly as possible to be able to play with it, even if it's not hooked up to the server, okay? So that in real code, that's what we do, because then you play with it, you make your little tweaks, and then it's half implemented already. You throw away maybe 10% of the code, right? But the rest is already done. And so the delivery phase, the iteration phase, is much quicker that way. Anyways, I'm almost out of time, so I'm not going to talk about this. This is how often you should meet with your people and your group. But even for this, they have templates. The EOS tells you what agenda to use for your weekly meetings. I mean, you don't really have to think about anything. It's all been proven and chosen, and you can use it over and over. Okay, last thoughts. This one took me a long time to figure out. I don't want to sell Balsamiq. This is my last, it's still my baby, but that's a problem. That means I'm not an entrepreneur. I should see it as a business separate from me. And so it does create a healthy separation between you and your company. And it forces you to make good financial choices. At any point, your business should be run well enough that it could be sold. So good profitability, good policies and all that. It forces good delegation. You have to have a good leadership team. That's something that acquirers look for. And then, there's a couple of books. Finish Big is a classic. And then Robin Sherry, second plug to Rob's book, Rook Literary. They're coming up with a fantastic book. I got to read it ahead of time for reviewing it. And it's really good. So buy these, keep them on your bedside table, even if you don't think about you're going to sell anytime soon. So this is all the stuff that we talked about. So if you have questions, let me know. And thank you.